The Big Interview.
It's The Big Interview with me, Peter, where I get to chat to interesting people about their life. And my guest for this edition is actor, YouTuber, radio presenter and advocate Stephen Hart. Now, Stephen spent 3 years training to be a nurse, then a year after qualifying, gave it up for showbiz. He's worked in London's West End in the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical Bombay Dreams, which I saw and I loved, so I'm going to chat about that, and off-Broadway with his one-man show about his life called Shadowed Dreamer. Stephen also talks publicly about living with HIV and works with the Terence Higgins Trust as a positive voice speaker, going into schools and businesses to tell his story. Stephen, hello.
Hello, Peter.
How are you, my lovely?
I'm good. Bit exhausted. It's been a full-on couple of days, but yeah, I'm very good.
Yes, you've been up here with eyes open. We're going to talk about that, doing the road show. So I want to find out people's reaction to your story, because it's an incredible story. But first of all, tell me about young Stephen. Where did you grow up? What was life like?
So I always say I was dragged up in Glasgow.
We've all been dragged up once in Glasgow, love.
So yeah, dragged up in... I was actually born in Birmingham, but I was adopted and moved to Glasgow. And that's where I grew up and lived there up until I was about 29 and then moved to sunny London to find my fame and fortune as an actor.
So what was Glasgow like? When did you know that blokes might be your thing? And was Glasgow welcoming to that?
So when did I know? It was when Marty Pelo and Wet, Wet, Wet.
Oh, yeah, we all had that one, didn't we?
Oh, Marty Pelo.
That smile.
Yeah.
It's the smile that
it
got me.
It was the smile. And yeah, that's when I was like, okay, something's a bit different here. So, I was very much in the closet. You know, I didn't come out until I was 21.
Wow.
I knew long before that, but Glasgow's a great place. It's a brilliant place to grow up and the people are wonderful, but I was just very scared of how it would be taken, you know.
And was that just you didn't want to upset or let down in inverted commas family or friends, or just wasn't right for you at that particular time to come out?
I think it was a bit of a combination of both. You know, I was scared of losing people. Gay wasn't something that we, you know, talk as openly about as we do today, you know, and I think I was scared of losing people. I was scared of letting people down. I was scared of the reactions of people. So that's why I kept it hidden for so long.
So there was this showbiz background. Was that always like buzzing as a young age? Were you a performer? Because I'm confused with the nurse bit. And the showbiz. What were you? Were you pretending to be, you know, Dr. Kildare and saving people? Or were you actually tap dancing away in musicals?
I think it might have been Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman.
God bless her.
I think what it was I was adopted and my teens had been very difficult because of my adopted mother had schizophrenia, so that background was tough, and I was kind of told that I had to get a normal job, and I'd fallen into acting at the age of 13 by a wonderful teacher, saw that I was struggling at home, and it wasn't in the days, it wasn't like now when teachers could ask you if something was wrong or step out and say something. And my music teacher just said to me, I think you need to audition for our school show. And I just thought, and she said, Stephen, you'll really enjoy it. And I got the lead child part in The Music Man. And so after that, it was instilled inside me. And I was just like, I would love to do this. But, you know, careers, you know, they said, oh, that's a hobby. So that's why I went into nursing. And I loved nursing. I was a hospice nurse. And I loved what I did. But I knew that the stage was where I wanted to be.
And did that feel as a safe space as a young gay man, the theatre? Because, you know, it's a very relaxed home for us all. We've all been there. You know, we felt safe. There was obviously part of the performing being somebody else. And, you know, if you were Freud, you could sit down and analyse it all the way why we all ran away and joined the theatre. But did you find it a safe space to be a little bit more you? Or were you just a show-off?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. People often said, you know, oh, we can't believe you're an actor. You're quite quiet. You're a bit shy, you know. And so, no, I wasn't out there. And, you know, it was. But as you say, it was stepping into a character's shoes, Peter. You know, it was becoming somebody else, which, as you say, could have a whole other, you know, side to it. But it was, I felt when I became somebody else, when I became this character, I could, yeah, just be that person. So, and I suppose being gay and being in the theatre, it's got a lot easier over the years. When I was in theatre in my early 20s, I was still quite, it wasn't something that I would, you know, put out there, you know, straight away. It was something that would eventually come out in conversation, but I wasn't out as a gay, proud actor, to be honest, back then. You know, it took time.
That's interesting, because most people like run away and join the circus and then they're showbiz all the way, but you struggled with that.
Yeah.
When was the moment that you had to get a profession? Mm-hmm. So I'm a nurse now. When was the time that you suddenly thought, do you know what? Was it a case, I can't do another shift like this because I'm not living my true authentic self, which goes back to, you know, coming out and living your true authentic self there? Or was it a case that, you know, you loved what you were doing, but you just wanted to be, you know, have the grease paint on and hear the applause?
It was a bit of a juggling thing, because I was working full time as a hospice nurse, as I said, which I loved. But then in my spare time, I was doing shows. I was doing, you know, I was doing my acting things. So I was kind of working 25 and a half hours a day, you know, trying to fit everything in. And it just got to the point where I knew I had to make a decision. And it was kind of, it's now or never. You know, and despite the fact that I'd trained and I'd done, you know, I'd done all that hard work, you know, to get to where I was, I knew that the acting gave me, nursing gave me something. It gave me a feeling of pride. It gave me a feeling of doing something important. But acting gave me that plus 10, you know, and I just thought, you know, if I don't give it a shot, then... Yeah.
But it's a big decision, because nursing gives you security.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You've got a paycheck at the end of the day. You know that next week you're going to work, and 6 months you're going to work, and 3 years you could be still going to work. In showbiz, it's completely different. So there's all that going on in your head to mm-hmm. make the decision from the leap of a normal trade mm-hmm. as such into something that you might not work for 5 years if you're lucky.
That's the thing about being an actor, you know, you have to be ready for the struggling, you know, because it can be tough and it takes time, and some people get there and some people don't, you know. And as you say, I was getting a regular wage being a nurse. I knew what my diary was. I knew, you know, it was organised and safe. And yeah, stepping out to be an actor was none of those things, you know.
And was that the move to London to become an actor?
No, so I did it in Glasgow for a number of years, but my mother's Scottish, my father's Puerto Rican, and I was this little mixed race kid growing up in Glasgow, and I didn't really fit in because, you know, just there wasn't, you know, a lot of people in Scotland back then looked as if they were Scottish, and, you know, and I'd come out with this Glaswegian accent and they'd be like, where the hell are you from, you know? So I wanted to stay in Glasgow, to be honest, and do it, make it there. That was my thing. But it was just really, it was difficult back then to be cast in anything, and I knew that opportunities would be bigger for me in London, and they were.
And you moved to London, and it's a bigger scene, and there's more LGBT people that are visible in the streets. And is that like Dorothy going through the doors and seeing that she's not in Kansas anymore, or was it a struggle to you?
It was great in one sense, because as you say, you know, people are here, people are proud of who they, you know, I just felt a lot more pride in being gay, being an out actor, you know, all those kind of things. So that side of it was great. But the struggle was just to be seen, because there's so many people, you know, wanting to, you know, that are chasing that dream, that are wanting, you know, the West End jobs, you know, and that was my aim, you know. I just wanted to be in the West End. So it was hard work, you know. Yeah, it was a struggle.
Well, it paid off, and we'll talk about it with Bombay Dreams. But I was privileged to be at the first Eyes Open event. And you came on stage and you told your story. And obviously, you know, tell as much or as little as you wish, but tell us what happened to you.
So I was in London. I eventually got a great job in the West End working in Bombay Dreams, the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical. And it was amazing. And then a few years after that, I was out one night with a friend and my drink got spiked in a bar. And I woke up the next morning and realised that I'd been raped. And it was kind of, you know, when I was trying to digest it and deal with what had happened, I kind of thought, but that doesn't happen to people like me. This is the thing you read about in the newspaper, and it's always somebody else. But it does happen to people like you and me, you know, I went to the hospital straight away, and I had my blood tests done for all the sexually transmitted infections, and everything came back clear. But I was told that I had to come back within 3 months to have a second HIV test done, and I didn't want to deal with it, you know, because being drugged with Rohypnol, you remember so little, and my mind just needed to be silenced and quiet, you know, quietened, you know. So I just went away for 6 months and tried to do anything I could do to forget what I couldn't remember. And yeah, it was a really dark time. And lo and behold, 6 months later, I decided to go back to the hospital because I thought, you know, it's time to start trying to deal with what had happened. And I tested positive for HIV.
Did any of your training as a nurse kick in? Because, you know, you follow a process, you're very practical and things. Or did that just go completely out of your head because this was you? It wasn't somebody else, as you said. And that disappearing for 6 months to find yourself is what you needed.
Well, I think, you know, I grew up in the time, Peter, of Section 28.
Yeah.
You know, so I was educated, in inverted commas, not, you know, there was nothing. So everything I knew about HIV and AIDS was from the newspapers. You know, I watched Freddie Mercury die, Kenny Everett die, you know, Rock Hudson, all these celebrities. And I remember we, in the hospital, I worked in a hospice for the year after my training. Yeah. And we had a girl in a side room who was end stage. She had an AIDS-defining illness. And I just remember that there was such a separation between me and her. And we weren't, you know, my training didn't give us much information about HIV, believe it or not, you know. And even when we had a patient, it was very much like they just need somewhere privacy for her and her family so that she can pass away, you know. So we didn't even have a lot to do with, so all that came back to me. Yeah. Rather than anything positive of how you can live with HIV. So I thought I was going to die, you know, because everybody I'd ever looked up to, you know, like, you know, film stars and things, that's what had happened to them. So yeah, I thought that was where I was going as well.
And how were you treated, there's a lot in the papers now about the Met Police, who would have dealt with your case. Were they sympathetic to you, or this doesn't happen to blokes, you know? What are you sure that, you know, you didn't egg this person on? Was there any judgment made on you, or did you find them, actually, they were great and they helped me through it?
So I called the police. No, I called the hospital after I realised what had happened, and they called the police, okay. And they came to my flat. And I always remember the two policemen coming in and saying, "What has happened?" And I said, "I think I've been raped." And one of the policemen, Peter, he frowned and he said, "But how? You're a guy." And I always remember for the next 2 years, I didn't call it rape. Even though that's what it was, I couldn't call it rape because somebody in authority, somebody who I thought would know about these things, said that it wasn't rape. And, said that doesn't happen, you know, to men. I found the police, I found the involvement then, you know, back in 2006, it was hard to talk about it with any of the police, and just I found it really tough.
And what about friends? How did they react? Again, was it hard to comprehend that this was a male rape, or did you find that you had a lot of support to help you through it?
I didn't tell them because I was so ashamed. A lot of people that have been raped will say that they felt that it was something that they'd done, you know, so there was a lot of blame on myself. What was I wearing? What, you know, had somebody at the, you know, there was obviously somebody sitting behind me. Our drinks were sitting beside us. And had he overheard our conversation? And, you know, when my friend had left the bar and I was there on my own. I didn't tell anybody for 2 years. So it was a very, very lonely time, and I didn't want to be here anymore. I just, you know, I just wanted to, you know, death to come quickly.
Was that therefore a struggle with intimacy issues for those 2 years and probably beyond? I mean, in those 2 years, did you manage to meet anyone and form a connection?
Not at all. And as you say, it took years, but, you know, before I could get back to feeling comfortable with somebody touching me or being that close to me. But, intimacy was off the table, you know, for a good number of years.
And you're in a profession where it's tits, teeth and feathers. It's showtime all the time, and you have to turn up to auditions and smile like the world's not on your shoulders, and you need this job. I've got no issues. Was that the hardest performance to give, or did you divorce yourself from work for a period of time because, you know, you couldn't be Mr. Hello Showbiz?
So I changed, Peter. I went from being on the stage to being a theatre manager, because that way I didn't have to be performing, you know, performing on stage or performing for just people around me. Being a theatre manager, I could be locked in my office a lot of the time, as long as, you know, the books were done and this was done, you know, and you knew who was on shift, all those kind of things. So I hid, you know, I hid away in an office and just tried to smile when I had to. And then I would go home every night and just, yeah, the tears would start. You know, I cried a lot in 2 years, and I always say I listened to a lot of Whitney Houston, you know, and just, that was as much as I could do. So acting stopped, which was also a very devastating, because I love it.
You changed your life for this.
Yeah, you know, so I was still earning money. I was still able to pay the bills, but I was surviving, you know. I was just going from day to day, and it wasn't living. It was just getting from one day to the next.
And when was that moment? You said that, you know, you didn't tell anybody for 2 years. When was that moment that you felt comfortable talking about it? And who was it with? Was it a close friend, a family member? Or sometimes some people talk to random strangers and it's amazing what you blur out, you know, because it's just that I don't know you and I can offload.
Well, I started writing, Peter. Somebody suggested journaling, which I was always like, no, thank you. It's not my thing. But then they said, what about writing your story? So I started writing my story for me, you know, never had the intention of sharing it with anybody. And all of a sudden I thought, I'm writing this and the people that are closest to me don't know. You know, not only was it that I'd been raped and that I had HIV, but also my childhood and, you know, growing up with a schizophrenic mother and you know, the things on that went on as a child. The people that were closest to me didn't know any of that. And I suddenly thought, I need to start telling people. And it wasn't telling people everything. It was to tell people that I was raped and that I had HIV, which was really tough because it's one thing telling people you've got HIV, but it's a double whammy to say I was raped and I have HIV, you know. So it was hard. It was really tough. And it was tough because it was, you know, a lot of it were people that I loved and seeing their hearts break each time you told them this. And often, even though it was me that was going through it, you were the shoulder to cry.
You're on. You're to apologise. Yeah. Are you all right to other people, are you?
Yeah, you know, so it was hard, but it started to open the door for me to at least be honest with my friends about HIV and that I was living with it. And yeah, that I suppose that was the start of me being more open and honest about my life.
So you've got this journal, you're now telling people. What was the step from still keeping it personal to now putting it out there, being on the radio, doing talks, making a show about it? It's not that you're playing a character. You haven't written a journal and called this person Tom or someone. This is you, and it's warts and all. What was the process of thinking, I'm going to now make this public?
Well, I always say that it was my agent, Andrea, because she called me and she said, what are you doing? And I told her about this writing and she said, oh, can I look at it? You know, I'd be really interested. And she said to me, you need to do something with this. She said, it's, you know, she said, this could help so many people. And as I said, it was never, ever what I intended to do, you know, and that she planted the seed in me to think, what more could I do with this? And I went away and started thinking about it and thought, you know, I always remember going to see one person shows, you know, one man shows or one woman shows, and thinking, how the hell do they do it? Because they've got nobody to rely on.
No safety net.
I've always been used to being on a stage with a huge cast, you know, and there's always, you know, as you say, a safety net. But I thought, maybe I could make this into a one man show. And I made my poor friends in London, you know, watch the early stages of it, you know, over and over again to see what worked, what didn't work, what I could put in and what take out and all that kind of thing. And eventually in 2010 it was completed and I thought, where do I go with it now, you know? And I decided to take it to New York.
As you do. Why not? You know, it's not in the back of a van touring Brighton. No, we're off to New York, love.
Do you know what it was? It was as a kid, you know, because things were so hectic at home, my escape was turning on the television and watching Little House on the Prairie or the Waltons or the, you know, the ideal family.
You so weren't gay, were you, love,
exactly.
Back then? How the family didn't know.
You know, and but also, you know, I always remember watching films that were set in the States and it always just lit a fire inside me, you know. And I'd never been to New York and I was just like, if I'm going to do this anywhere, why don't I try New York? So I packed my bags up and went over to New York and hoped that maybe I would get a month over there. And lo and behold, Shadow Dreamer ran for 9 months. It closed off Broadway and it was reviewed by the New York Times, who said that it was vital, necessary theatre.
What was the response? Because here's a mixed race guy with a Scottish accent coming over to talk about, you know, a subject matter that's dark and deep.
Did they get it? I mean, did they see past all that and it was the narrative that hooked them, or was the disbelief in the audience, you know? What was their response?
I suppose there was a range of responses from shock, horror, you know, to so many people just wanting to come up and put their arms around me, you know, so many people sharing their own stories. That was the bit I didn't expect, you know. I didn't expect to get back to the apartment at night, and the email account that I'd set up, you know, so that people could find out when the show was on, where it was on, to open that up, Peter, and to be these stories from people. I think also, you know, my story is, it's hard, you know, but there's also elements of fun. Yeah. And happiness, you know, that, you know, and you know, and I always end on a high, you know, and it's so, and it's amazing how many things that people can connect with, you know, and maybe not everything that's in the story, but so many people came up and said, oh, we had schizophrenia, yeah, in our family,
there's
or
other
mental
elements,
health, so, you know, and, you know, so they always could connect to something. And I always tended to do it in a small black box type, yeah, theatre. So as soon as I walked on stage, I connected with the audience straight away. And as you say, it was quite strange. Where do I put it in my head? Because I'm not playing a character. I'm playing me. And that's a bit of a mind bending thing, you know, because you're like, I can't step into this person's shoes because I'm already in them and I've lived it and I've been there and everything is real. And it's a lot of work, you know. I used to get off stage every night and just be drained, but the response was unbelievable.
But do you think, I mean, you're telling your story, you're reliving it every time. Now you've relived it, you know, every time that you tell it. Was that because for 2 years you never told anyone, and this, you need to keep telling it? Though you come off stage and you're exhausted, is it a relief a little bit more that, yeah, you know, I've knocked down that other brick in my wall? Or is it now it's a story and the reaction that you get is from the audience?
I think, you know, I'd grown up in a family, Peter, where it was secrets. You know, there were secrets about my mother's mental health, secrets about being adopted, secrets about being gay, secrets, secrets, secrets. And by the time I got to 30 odds, I couldn't keep secrets anymore because I knew how damaging they were. So it was difficult because it was, as I say, it's hard to get up there and do that and relive those, you know, go back to those places in your head and in your heart, because you want to be genuine to your audience. So you have to kind of take yourself back to those places to relay the story as honestly and as truthfully as you can. There was a feeling of seeing my story doing some good made my story have a reason. And I think for years I had longed for why. And when I was raped, why me? You know, and all of a sudden I thought, this is why me, because there was something more that you can do with what has happened to you.
Have you found love since?
From time to time.
Oh, lovely. is there still a block that appears, or actually, you know, you're okay and you're moving forward in yourself?
I'm in a good place, you know. I'm single, but I'm
just putting it out there, lads.
Just
putting it out there,
just in case anybody wanted to know.
She's on Tinder.
Yeah, you know. But yeah, it took a long time. It took a long time to be able to walk into a bar alone again, all those kind of things, you know. And every now and again there'll be something, you know, that will trigger a memory or just a vision from that night, you know. But at the same time, I know now that it wasn't my fault. And when you get to that point, that's an amazing point to get to, because all of a sudden all that shame, all that, you know, that I'd been holding on to for all that time suddenly started to drain away, you know. And so now I'm very willing and open and happy to take any names and numbers.
She's single and she's mingling.
But I think, you know, just at the top of the story, we were kind of talking that there you are, a nurse, and you give being a carer up to going to theatre. But now you've kind of combined it, because you are actually providing a caring service by telling your story, because a lot of people, as you say, will listen to it. I remember speaking to some younglings, as I call the chickens on the scene, and they would say, oh yeah, you know, last week, woke up in this guy's bed, can't remember getting there. And I was sitting there going, you do know that you might have been raped, you know. Oh, no, he just bought me some drinks, but no memory of it. And it was that flippant kind of thing that sometimes we dismiss it as stuff. So having your story out there is incredibly important. What's the response been? You've been here in the northeast of England. You've probably told the story 5 or 6 times now in the past few days. What's the response been?
It's been great. It's been, yeah, it's just, it's reminded me of the power of our stories, you know, and I'm always reminded of that every time I tell my story, because whether people ask the questions there in the Q&A that I do, or whether they come over afterwards and just have a little chat with you in the corner, or send you messages, you know, on social media, it reminds me that our stories are important. You know, and I started a YouTube channel, and I always try to tell other people's stories on my channel, because I know I had the space to tell mine. So yeah, that's just what I try to do.
Bollywood Dreams, was it as camp backstage as it was on stage? Because it was a riot of colour and water and gorgeousness.
Yeah, so Bombay Dreams was it was so much fun. It was such a buzz, and it was water, it was saris, it was, and I was playing a eunuch.
As you do,
you know. I always remember my agent said they want to see you for the role of Sweetie. That Sweetie's a eunuch, and I was like, yeah. Had to go home and Google what eunuch was. I was like,
what do I wear, a horn?
Yeah,
and I've got a mane and I run around.
Exactly. I was like, so, but it was. Do you know? I look back on it and kind of go, did that happen? Because it was so amazing. And, you know, I've still got friends all the, because it was 2002, you know, I've still got friends now that I made on that show. Yeah, it was the best.
Boy from Glasgow did well.
Boy from Glasgow did good.
If people want to engage with you, Stephen, how can they do that?
So my YouTube channel is called Heart Talks. I'm on Instagram, Heart Talks 72. I'm on Facebook, all the others, on Twitter, you'll find me, Stephen Hart.
Well, it's been a joy speaking to you, and we're going to go away and you're going to show me some of those dance routines, because I do remember them and they were gorgeous.
I'm glad you remember them, because I don't.
Thank you.
The Big Interview.